This is Fordham Conversations. I'm John Blythe. Poets have long been a voice in American political life. Think back to the beginnings of this nation when Joel Barlow published his epic salute to the new land, The Vision of Columbus, or to the Civil War and Walt Whitman's portraits of the disruption and futility of war in Drum Taps, or even to the dawn of the 60s and Robert Frost's recitation of The Gift Outright at John F. Kennedy's inauguration. Poets, it seems, bring an air of dignity to our highest state occasions. But a year ago, a White House poetry event hosted by First Lady Laura Bush was canceled after one of the poets threatened to use that occasion to protest the war in Iraq. And in the subsequent media coverage, some questioned whether poetry and politics mix. What role does poetry play in our public life? What makes a poem political? And is one that comments on the events of the day, by its nature, bad art? Today we'll examine those questions with Scott Hightower. He's a poet and professor of English at Fordham University. Hightower is the author of 3 collections of poetry and is currently at work on his 4th. That collection will in part look at democracy and the Constitution. Hightower says poets and politicians begin at the same place, using language. But politicians often veer off into rhetoric and propaganda.
Rhetoric and propaganda are not the things that poets should be aspiring to. Rhetoric is something it's a little piece of something like a metaphor or a position that can be used in a poem. And there's an old thing about poetry should show and not tell. I don't happen to agree with that. I think poetry can tell. Telling is a part of the human experience too. But you want to tell it well. I mean, people can tell badly or they can tell well. And so the same thing. You can have rhetorical passages or moments or trills in a poem, but a poem itself is not a chunk of rhetoric. A poem is a poem. And a poem may have a part song, part story. It may have some rhetoric in there. But what I'm setting out to do is to be a poet and to write a poem is certainly different than setting out to create a rhetorical machine that's going to that some consumer is going to be eaten up by. Not into that.
Does it cheapen the art? Does it cheapen the poetry then to have a political, even an overtly political message in poetry?
Probably all poetry has a political economy to it. I would agree if someone says just because you have suddenly political content into a bunch of language doesn't make it a poem, or if it's a poor poem, a bad poem can have political language in it, but you could also have a very good poem with political language in it. So whether there's politics in or out of the content of the poem isn't really what you're asking about. You're asking about the quality of a poem, and that's a little different about, you could also ask about the quality of politics.
Who's done it well?
Who does it well? Well, someone like Browning. I mean, almost every age has got somebody. I would say Auden in the 20th century, even though he was kind of the politics around him being driven out, having a foster country, living here even in New York City, and seeding out and teaching other young poets. I mean, as you know, I look to Auden as kind of the basic principle, asking us about poets to think about their relationship to society, to their God, and to their fellow man.
Did W.H. Auden say that?
Well, he was actually, I think it was maybe Pound or some earlier poets that were kind of talking with Auden, saying if you didn't get the poets out of the basement, they were all writing about flowers and birds, and that at that time in the world, the poets really, as other artists, should be called upon to address the real struggles of people. There were real dangers and real risks and real things that needed to be addressed, and it looked foolish for poets to just be dallying about birds and flowers. That's not to say that you can't write great poetry about birds and flowers, but you should also be able to write great poems about constitutional figures or great poems about democratic principles, or you should be able to, you know, a good poem should be able to wrap itself around anything. And there might even be different poems. I mean, you could write one poem that salutes and thinks favorably of a presidential role, and you could write another poem that mocks it and speaks to power in a very different kind of way. It's all pretty valuable. Could be valuable.
Well, you've mentioned democracy and constitutional forms. Mm-hmm. Your 4th collection of poetry that you're working on right now is titled Self-Evident. Mm-hmm. And when I hear that term, I immediately think of the Declaration of Independence, those words of Thomas Jefferson. I want you to discuss that in just a second, but first, why don't you read the poem for us?
Okay. A short little poem, and it's a hyphenated title, Self-Evident. Jefferson penned, "We hold these truths to be," and sent off the draft to Franklin, his colleague, who in turn crossed out and pinned over the word, sacred.
And that's actual a story behind that.
Yeah, yeah. It comes. You can actually go on the internet and pull up the draft of the manuscript that he was working on, and it was like a writing workshop. Here, his assignment that night is to write the Declaration of Independence. He draws up a draft of it, and then he sends it over to his colleague to make notes or make changes or suggestions on his draft. And that happens to be a historical famous figure. And the first thing he didn't like on that draft was, "We hold these truths to be sacred," and drew a line, crossed it out, and above it is the word self-evident. And so you can actually still see that manuscript with that handwriting above that word, and that is inspiration for the whole book of poetry.
And what drew you to that little incident, that little change in text?
You know, I'm not for sure. I think I was actually looking at it. I think I was just reading. I'm interested in people that write, and the idea that all these politicians left a lot of writing, and not only is it typed out, but you can actually go look at their scripts, the manuscripts. And I pulled that up on the internet and was looking at it one night and saw that this word was changed, and then got curious if that was the first draft or if it was a later, whose handwriting was it, exactly what was going on with that correction, because it seems like a big correction to take out the word sacred and replace it with self-evident. And then that was the inception for the whole way of thinking that I'm kind of onto right now.
What is the difference between sacred and self-evident as you see it or as you choose to explore it in this book? Yeah. I know you don't want to always ask an artist to explain everything that they do, but...
Yeah, a pretty clear answer that would be that there are ideas and political structures and language that fall more into the realm of the medieval and even forms of government. And then there are ways of thinking and systems and language that fall more on the other side of the Enlightenment. And I think that sacred is it's an interesting word and an old word and a lovely word, but self-evident definitely falls on a little bit closer to my reality right now. And you know, and you can even see that I think even in the, like in the not to even cause trouble, but in some other countries where governance is really more medieval than democratic, and large medieval systems of governance in the modern world don't work very well. They often lead to tyrannies or to oppression, or they lead to Byzantine repressive forms of governance on people, and which is why, you know, I'm not an apologist for democracy, but I think that democracy, with its systems of guaranteed participation and then checks and balances that ensure that, are very, very important. They're critical to our existence.
And what's drawn you to this whole issue of democracy and constitution? I mean, you're a Texan. You moved to New York some 20-something years ago. You've written 3 previous volumes of poetry, some of them exploring your roots in Texas. How do you arrive now to talk about our political system?
Yeah. Well, in Texas, politics is a hobby. I mean, even as little kids, we're political and we're raised on talking and thinking about politics. And it's at the table and it's in the schools. It's everywhere, as is also religion. So I think for my own interests in the way that we organize and reward, find happiness, give support, find generosity, the way, you know, that spirit and politics are all have linguistic principles and have economic principles that I'm interested in. And it certainly arises out of some of the problems with the present American foreign policy, which everybody's reading about and thinking about, the election, the deaths of notable figures. All these things bring up all kinds of jargon and brings up all kind of whitewashes or, spin. And being a poet, I'm always interested in seeing how people are using language. And it's very clear to me that some people are using language in a way that keep me thinking, that extend the depths of my understanding of the world around me, that keep my generosity wider, that make me a better person. And so language that keeps the sparks going is really dynamic, and I'm drawn to it, and it deepens me. But I'm also, being a bit older and more experienced than some of the kids, have learned to be suspicious, because some people use language in a way that stops you from thinking. It wants you to, like I think you know, the word suicide bomber was an interesting case that comes more out of journalistic use. But that really doesn't tell you how old this person is, what the circumstance, if it was a Chechenian widow or is it a teenage Palestinian boy, or where was this person born, what's their economic reality. I mean, one word, suicide bomber, doesn't really give you any news.
We think of poetry and politics, we think, say, of Pablo Neruda in Chile, and he moved a lot of people, and he, you know, the people who were feeling great unease with politics there could find something in Neruda's words, or Poland's Czesław Miłosz, or even Solzhenitsyn in Russia. Is poetry doing that in this country?
Yeah, I think for those who want it, those who are looking for the word and reading and seeking, yeah, I think there's good stuff out there, absolutely, yeah.
Who are you thinking of?
Oh, Richard Howard, Sandy McClatchy, Alfred Korn, Marie Ponceau, Aaron Ballou, Kathy Fagan, you know, the list is long. I mean, there are people that are only 19 and 20 years old that have an awful lot to say, and they're writing really good stuff. It's very dynamic here right now. It's an exciting time to be a poet.
Well, there are some who see poetry as a voice for the voiceless. Is poetry at its best when it is a voice for the voiceless?
I think that's why I probably throw my lot in with poetry. Poetry is the most committed to giving voice to those who can't, or it believes in a multiplicity of voices. The singularity of a voice is one of the most dangerous things, once again, back to democracy, or If you have a tyrant that's running your country, you have one voice, and everybody has to jump or dance to that single voice. As long as you've got a good tyrant, that's okay. If you've got a bad tyrant, then you're in real trouble. I would much rather be in a democratic system where you have checks and balances and guaranteed participation and a system of active people that are listening and watching. Because then if you have a bad leader, well, then you can survive a bad leader. Bad leaders will come and go. Good leaders will come and go. But what you have is, you know, this kind of, it's not slippage, but it's shared responsibility. Responsibility is distributed among the collective rather than being isolated into the authority of one person. So I think poetry by its nature is interested in multiple voices. It's interested in the authority of each poet. It's interested in the authority of every life. And so, therefore, no one should be marginalized. And those who are marginalized are the ones who need the activity of the populace the most. I think that's why issues with presidents in the United States get into a lot of trouble. They can be dynamic leaders on some front, but if they're not taking care of the marginalized and the suffering in America, and how do you reconcile people that are disenfranchised? It gets into notions of citizenry, and whether you draw a line around a nation and then just say everybody inside of this boundary is going to get the goods, or if you have kind of like a spider, a central core with legs that come off of it, and only those people, that's the Roman system of citizenry. But the citizenry of poetry is anyone that can find their voice, and anyone's perspective and point of view, what they've seen, what they've gone through, what's given them their authority informs their song, and that song's valuable and of interest.
And you use the term democracy to quote one Scott Hightower in a poem called Walking at the UN.
Yeah.
You write, writing more specifically, poetry lies at the elemental core of democracy. I want you to read the full poem and then tell me a little bit again about the thinking there.
Walking at the UN. New poets often stand in witness. Occasionally are the conscience of power. The old stones envisioned in a new way, a rhapsodic undulation of the tallow world. This afternoon I visit a friend, a deputy of the European Commission. He and I walk in the UN Rose Garden. Last time I was here, the garden was opened to the public. He explains, since September 11th, the gardens have only been accessible to UN employees and their guests. The sun burns like a wick in our conversation, and later in the unpredictable current of the river. How from island to island notions find their way, even as the unparsed narratives of the conquered and vanquished do not, in the presence of mine enemy. You are skillful parched corn, to my American scalawag. But we both have read our Donne and Paine, and malice is not a binder or a virtue in our shared rubric. Writing, more specifically poetry, lies at the elemental core of democracy. By definition, it seeks a foundation for the commonwealth in the truth of the individual, guaranteed and restored through the integrity of language.
Seems to sum up much of what we've just been talking about.
Yeah, that's pretty much cuts to the quick of it. Read you a couple more.
Sure, please.
Kind of expand rather than reduce down that notion from Natural Trouble.
This is your second collection.
Right. And this gets back to the word that I was speaking of earlier, the suicide bomber. The poem is called Carriage, and it does mention an incident that took place here in New York, but I think it's all pretty self-explanatory in the poem. Carriage. The assassins that blow themselves to bits with the same bomb they use to snipe. Suicide bombers. The sleek journalistic formula, suicide bomber, has so much slippage it can be read on one hand, freedom fighter, on the other, vicious sociopath. What are we led to do with an epithet that parades the epaulets of non-judgmental information, but which, in actuality, stops thought? And is there any decency or fair play in deception? Doesn't turning oneself into a mechanism of delivery and detonation mean that one is actually a part of the bomb? How and when exactly was the moniker Ground Zero settled on? Tullio Lombardo's Atom shattered one evening at the Met, collapsed of its own volition, alone, like some pagan god who, abandoned by his mortal worshippers, threw himself on the floor and smashed himself to bits. The Conoscenti had to collect and number the pieces of marble strewn on the museum floor, which was cordoned off by tape and string like a crime scene, arms and legs, a torso, and a head. The features of the face suffered only minor losses, mostly scratches. One leg was broken into 6 large pieces. Other parts had been smashed into smaller bits. There was some pulverizing. Besides its strong classical references, the statue was noted for the purity of its marble, its smooth carving, and its elegant hand, which held an apple. There was a serpent and a grapevine.
Scott Hightower is the author of 3 collections of poetry and a professor of English at Fordham University. More from him in a moment. You're tuned to 90.7 WFUV and WFUV.org. This is Fordham Conversations. I'm John Plythe. We're talking today about poetry. Poet Scott Hightower says as he pens his poems, he's well aware that he's writing for more than just himself.
The truth for me is that there's kind of an internal committee of my teachers, my family members. My mother sits on that committee, Richard Howard, Alfred Korn, Sandy McClatchy, Marie Ponceau, all of my teachers that I've had sit in that kind of internalized committee. And so, and not only living people, dead people, Virgil is there and Sappho. So I think that there are people who have lived, people who are alive, and maybe future people who will read the poem.
It's a tough committee.
It's a tough committee, but as we said earlier, you know, that really worthwhile art, original art, authentic art, valuable art, isn't made in an accident. It's determined. It's gone after. It's esteemed to. It's like democracy. It's an ideal that you're always working toward, and you may not have ever quite achieved it, but if you don't set out to do something good and worthwhile and valid, then you're certainly not going to accidentally create something with high merit. But so the answer is I've got an internal committee of people which brings my standard or my own excavations and explorations in language. I think every writer is setting out to do something a little unique and authentic. And hopefully they've thought a little bit about what it means to be original and what it means to be an author, an authority of those words that way, And yeah, I think you, I mean, art is semi-social. I mean, I'm not just creating for me. That would just be masturbatory or narcissistic. Or, I mean, art is a social, and not only because of my intentions or the purpose of it, but the nature of the medium. When you're writing a poem, you're using language, and language is a social medium. And so if the medium you're using is a socially created and activated medium, then the thing that you're creating is going to be social also.
You talk about poetry, the art of poetry, the artist. I'm just thinking here, you know, the novelist or the painter, strikes me that they're more likely to find success than a poet in this country. Mm. I mean, is the life of a poet in this country tough? I mean, is there enough of an audience for poetry? Does it have to rhyme in order for it to find an audience?
Well, there's a huge audience for poetry in the sense that it can be read, it can be re-inhabited by somebody for hundreds and hundreds of years. I mean, the poetry is extremely conservative and extremely enduring. If you had Sappho come into your house and look around, she wouldn't relate to the glass and the material, the aluminum, the refrigerator, and almost everything in your house would throw her off. And if you went and looked in Sappho's house, you might not exactly understand, you know, how to get fed or for to do your business. But if Sappho came in your house and she said, John, I want to see a poem. Have you written a poem? Put one of your poems on the table. And then you put one of her poems beside your poem on the table. Well, she would get it in a minute. I mean, she would understand it, you know, it would just be evident. There it is. The poetry.
If I was a good poet.
Maybe even if you're a bad poet, I would like to think that she would be insightful and generous enough to say, this is your poem and this is my poem. This is the same thing. So I think the medium of poetry in that sense is very, very enduring. Glass will come and go. Buildings will come and go. Civilizations, power structures will come and go. And poems are still with us. So the possibilities for your audience are as far as humanity is willing to take its material, you know.
I asked you about the lot of a poet in this country. You're competing with, in terms of sales and getting your poetry out there, you're competing with Emily Dickinson, Walt Whitman, the ones that seem to get grabbed off the shelf quickly. Will we always be buying Dickinson and Whitman?
Mm-hmm. Well, but first let me address about competition. The only person I compete with is me, and that's kind of a linguistic thing why I worry about, why I fret, that I think in America, one other reason I started this project, it seemed to me in the United States that we've gotten away from our commitment to democratic principles and organization in our daily life or in our governance, and we're opting for a more corporate model, and that troubles me. And whether you're talking about our nation or you're talking about the country club or the classroom or the school that you teach in or the job you have, if it's run more like a corporation than like a democracy, then we as Americans need to be talking and thinking about that. So I would just offer that I compete only with myself. It's a corporate idea that I would be competing with Emily Dickinson and Walt Whitman. Now, having said that, I want to mention something about them. I believe that maybe the reason that Americans don't read the Bible or read Shakespeare, not all of them, but certainly the educated ones do, is because in some way Emily Dickinson and Walt Whitman are our basis of our literature in that sense. And if you think of Emily Dickinson as being our Shakespeare, and you think as Walt Whitman as being in the model of the Bible, the rhetorical passages of the Bible, then in some ways, when we talk about Emily Dickinson and Walt Whitman, in England you would be talking about the Bible and Shakespeare. And I have this silly idea. One day I'd like to do a play of Shakespeare and take out all the monologues and put in Emily Dickinson poems, because then you realize that they're really soliloquies and quite beautiful.
I'd like to see that play.
Yeah.
Poetry, certainly, I think folks would say poetry has found a mass audience in the form of rap music or these mm-hmm. slam poetry mm-hmm. events. I mean, take Russell Simmons's Deaf Poetry Jam on Broadway. Do you feel a kinship with these forms?
A broad kinship, yes. You know, I think there are audiences that are hungry for that, and there are people that are celebrating thinking and language and fulfilling a vital part of the life of our nation. In that sense, all that, back to democratic principle, do I think those people are doing something that's valuable? Absolutely. It's not the same thing that I'm doing. And I know that you asked some questions before we started taping about an academic audience or academic poetry. But I think that's also a part. I mean, I'm not interested in dialogue that says it's this or that and that exclusively. I really come from the fundamental thing that believes that there should be guaranteed participation and protections for all of those things, that participation. So I'm not threatened by a rapper. I'm not threatened by a more public poet who's interested in high culture or a poet who's interested in popular culture. I mean, I kind of move around and dip and choose from all that stuff. I'll take a little bit of all that and work it in. I'm not interested in people that say, well, poetry should only rhyme. Poetry should only be this or that, or it can't make reference to intellectual property. It can't make reference to history or anything you'd have to look up. It can't be Mandarin, is the only phrase you hear. But I'm also not interested in people that think that something is too low or is not interesting. I mean, there's a very broad possibility of human expression. And there's clearly many ages and many geographical needs out there for people to hear clear or entertaining thought. And some of that stuff will set a little coal on fire, or some kid will hear something and that will open a new door for them. I'm just interested in the thought of our polis. The thought of our citizenry is something that I'm thinking about right now.
And speaking of the thought of our citizenry, the past year and a half, just before the outbreak of war in Iraq, France and the United States headed their separate ways in terms of their feelings about the war, and that in this country created a great bit of anti-French sentiment. You explore the historic context of the Franco-American relation in a poem to be published in your collection, Self-Evident, Philadelphia versus Paris. I'd like for you to read that now.
Oh, yeah. A little dry on the end, but maybe you can stay with me. It's called Philadelphia versus Paris. Americans and Europeans have different understandings of constitutional democracy. The great idea of democracy, with its systems of checks and balances and notion of rule by elected and accountable agency, rises like a great and shiny clock out of a set of fixed expressions of rights. It is established on a constitution, fixing realms for both precedent and creativity. Nationalism gets reconciled. It is like a poem about establishing a timeless set of principles of fairness, oddly beyond the reach of sovereignty by popular notion. But Americans and Europeans, approaching common experiences, but informed by their separate histories, are drawing different conclusions. America has a cheerful understanding of nationalism expressed through democracy. Europe has a horror of popular nationalism. A poem, too, by definition, is a political reconciliation.
Well, tell me, Scott Hightower, what drew you to poetry? Let's hear the Scott Hightower biography.
Oh, Lord. Probably the first poems I heard were in a church. I think that's probably true. Hymns and prayers and things. Books were always around the house. Storytelling is a big part of the Southern tradition. The first browsing in a school library, there was a big, fat, worn red book with some marginalia, and I always liked marginalia. And there was a little piece of a verse that I read, and absolutely I felt like the bottom of the floor had fallen out, and then a little further, and then it just kept falling through the trap doors. And that was by Wordsworth. I'll never forget it. It's the part that says, what though the radiance be so bright, be now forever taken from my sight, though nothing can bring back the hour of splendor in the grass, of glory in the flower, I will grieve not, rather find strength in what remains behind. And that sounds kind of dopey, but those words were just blazoned into my soul. I really understood and got it. And then from then on, I've been writing.
Well, Scott Hightower, thanks for speaking with me.
Yeah, it's been fun.
Scott Hightower is a poet and professor of English at Fordham University. His third collection of poetry, titled Part of the Bargain, is due out next year from Copper Canyon Press. That's it for Fordham Conversations this week. I'm John Blythe. Have a good weekend.